From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's really no secret how President Trump feels about immigration. His policies are as much about building a legal wall as an actual physical border wall. More than once, he has claimed that immigrants won't or don't or can't contribute to American society, essentially that they will not assimilate. Well, President Trump is not the only member of his administration to make such claims. For example, here is then White House Chief of Staff John Kelly in May of 2018.
Let me step back and tell you that the vast majority of the people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. They're not criminals. They're not MS-13. But they're also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States. They're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They're coming here for a reason, and I sympathize with the reason. But the laws are the laws.
Well, my guests today are economic historians who are checking some of the emotional claims made about immigration and assimilation against what the actual data say. They're using vast big data sets in new ways to understand America's immigrant story. So this hour in Point, economic historians, the data, and American immigration. Well, joining us today from Princeton, New Jersey, is Leah Bustan and Ron Abramitsky. He joins us from Stanford, California. Leah is a professor of economics at Princeton, and Ron is a professor of economics at Stanford University. They've been working together for more than a decade and are co-authors of a recent paper published in the journal American Economic Review Insights. And that paper is titled, Do Immigrants Assimilate More Slowly Today Than in the Past? Leah Bustan, first of all, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Ron Abramitsky, again, at Stanford, California. Ron, welcome to you.
Thanks for having us.
Leah, first let me start with you. What got you and Ron interested in this question about how data and economics might be able to answer the question of assimilation in America?
Well, we noticed that politicians today, both on the left and on the right, have a nostalgic view of immigrants in the past and will often say that immigrants arrived with very little, with only a dollar in their pocket, and quickly moved up the economic ladder, and also that immigrants took active steps in the past to join U.S. society. And in some cases, like in the case of President Trump, there'll be an explicit contrast with immigrants today, who can be blamed for living in immigrant enclaves, not learning English, and not taking steps to assimilate. So we wanted to take a look at the big data and bring some information and facts to bear on this debate. Many historians and sociologists have looked at specific communities, but what we can add is the ability to examine millions of records, both in the past and today. So we've worked on both of those dimensions, economic upward mobility, and today in our new paper, cultural assimilation as well. And we find, quite in contrast, a striking degree of similarity between immigrants in the past and immigrants today.
Uh-huh. So we will explore what those similarities are. But Ron, tell me more. Is this a question that's raging in economic circles?
Well, you know, it is to a large degree because we have a sense, you know, Leah and I from working on this together often with our co-author Catherine Erickson, that cultural assimilation may actually be more important in the policy and public debate than economic integration. And the thing is that measuring cultural assimilation is challenging because data on the cultural practices of immigrants is not something that is systematically collected. And so we thought, you know, like, a little bit of introspection. So I am an immigrant. And when my three, we moved to the United States 20 years ago from Israel, and our kids are named Roy, 16 years old, and then Ido, and then Tom. So we figured, you know, like we can, you know, like we can use the names that immigrants give their children as one way to measure, like potentially the benefits of the cultural assimilation of immigrants.
Mm. Okay, we will definitely take a deep dive into this question of names because I have been obsessed with talking to you about it because I have a lot of perhaps pointed questions about it. But what I want to actually do before we get there is this idea of quote-unquote cultural assimilation, that in and of itself is a very amorphous notion. I mean, in a way, the debate over cultural assimilation is the debate over what it means to be an American. So how, I mean, if you're going to do any sort of big data analysis, you have to have a baseline for, to work from. So Leah, how are you and Ron, first of all, defining what assimilation even means in this context?
Well, the nice thing about our approach is that we don't take any stand at the beginning about what it means to be an American. It might sound like a tautology, but what it is to be an American is to do what Americans do. And so as Americans change over time, now many Americans are second generation children of immigrants from Latin America and Asia, and that was not the case 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. So as that population changes, the definition of what it means to be American changes as well. And for us, what it means to be American comes out of the data. So we need many, many cases so that we can see, on average, what do Americans do? So if Americans on Sunday go to the supermarket instead of going to church, then that's what it means to be American. 100 years ago, if it was quite the opposite, then that's what it would mean at that time. So given that we need to have a lot of information about what Americans do, that was one of the reasons why we turned to looking at names, because names are recorded in government documents. And so that's something that we can pull out from the past.
So, Ron, go ahead.
And I would just want to add from the very beginning that nothing in what we do tells us that immigrants should assimilate or, you know, like into the broader, more dominant American culture. Rather, what we do is we ask the question, you know, when immigrants look at the world and they see the potential benefits and the costs of assimilating into the broader society, do they assimilate or did they assimilate? And asking the questions of, is the nostalgic view that Leah was talking about, that immigrants in the past were much faster in assimilate and they didn't expect America to change for them, but rather they change for America, and that's as opposed to immigrants today, whether this claim is true.
So let's start by taking a look then at what time period did you look at in the past, and this question of names, for example. Leah, are we talking mid-19th century? What time period did you look at?
So we're looking at kids who are living at home with their parents in 1920, in the 1920 census, which means that they were born somewhere between 1900 and 1920. And we made that choice very intentionally because in 1921, the U.S. begins to impose a set of immigration restrictions, a set of quotas that eventually drastically limit immigration to the country. But by 1920, immigration had been open from Europe and nearly unrestricted for 50 or 60 years. So we're looking at a period of mass migration when in some cities, 40 or 50% of the population was foreign-born.
So this is the great period of sort of Ellis Island-esque European immigration to the United States. And you looked and you said you were looking at census records of about families, about children's names. What is the big data set in particular that you looked at?
Well, we're taking advantage of the fact that the historical census records have been kept in government archives for, in some cases, over 100 years. And 72 years after the survey was taken, they become open to the public. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, if you're a genealogist and you want to go and look at your grandparents, you can find them in the census data. And maybe some people listening have done that through Ancestry.com. You can type in your grandparents' name, and you can find your grandparent there and see where were they living, what was their occupation, who was living next door to them. What we're doing is basically dealing with the data set that's underlying a search engine like that. You know, so the millions of records that are in a digitized database and that can be used for research purposes.
Okay, so Ron, then specifically, what is in that data set that you that you began to analyze and tried to draw some conclusions out of?
So we looked at various dimensions of cultural assimilation. For example, we looked at whether the tendency of immigrants to marry outside of their group and whether they self-report speaking English. Did they apply to citizenship, which at the time was relatively easy to get, but you kind of needed to want to be identify yourself with America. And then we looked at the names that immigrants give their children. And the point is that names are a signal of cultural identity, and they kind of reflect a choice to assimilate. So if you want who you marry, is both a choice who you want to marry, but it's also who wants to marry you. Whether if you, when you give, when a child was born, you give, the immigrant can give child a name, and it's free of immigrants, of native, say, discrimination or anything like that. And moreover, giving a child an American sounding name is financially cost free way of identifying with the U.S. culture. So it doesn't cost money to name your child. Now, of course, in economics, we know that the fact that it's financially cost-free doesn't make it totally cost-free. So if I named my son Jared, then my mom would be on the other side of the phone and would tell me, hey, like, how is Jared part of your original Israeli cultural identity? But it's exactly trading off maintaining your own cultural identity with for the benefits of assimilation. And then this measure allows us also to compare the cultural assimilation of immigrants over the last 100 years. And so Leah talked about the census data in the past. Of course, today you don't have access to all this identifying information in the census. So we needed to be to find other creative ways. So we got access to birth certificates in California that allow us to see the names that mothers give their children. And then we can compare immigrants in the past and today.
Okay, so we'll talk more about then about what these data sets say from 1920 versus today about cultural assimilation when we come back. So Leah Bustan and Ron Abramitsky, hang on here for just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Leah Bustan. She's a professor of economics at Princeton University. And with Ron Abramitsky. He's a professor of economics at Stanford University. And for several years, they've been working together to use the techniques of big data to answer the question about assimilation in America. And they've released a recent paper in the journal American Economic Review Insights. And that paper is titled, Do Immigrants Assimilate More Slowly Today Than in the Past? And again, as I said, they're using really interesting big data sets to help get a statistical or factual answer to that somewhat amorphous question. So Leah, let me turn back to you here. And as just to remind folks, you said that the first sort of wave of immigration that you looked at was roughly, 1880-ish to 1920. And you looked at census data that was released. So when Ron said that you tried to examine, put simply, how the frequency of marrying outside of groups or citizenship, rates of citizenship application, what did you find? I mean, did it happen more quickly 150 years ago or 140 years ago than it's happening today?
We don't see very many differences whether the measure is intermarriage, learning English, applying for citizenship, or our favorite measure, which is the names that immigrants give to their children between past and present. So what we particularly like about looking at names is that people will have multiple children over their lifetime, and the first child might be born after 1 or 2 years in the country, and then the next child might be born 5 or 6 years later. So we end up getting snapshots of immigrant attitudes as they spend more time in the U.S. Some of the other measures that we look at are really a one-shot deal. You know, do you apply for citizenship or not? And who do you get married to at the moment of marriage? And what's nice about NAMES is that we can trace out this assimilation profile over an immigrant's lifetime. And what we find is that the kids that immigrants have after a year or two in the country are given names that are really quite different from the kids of the U.S. born. And then as you go through time and you look at a child who's born after 10 or 20 years in the country, the naming gap has substantially closed between immigrants and natives. And the gap closes to almost the same degree, strikingly so, in the past and today.
So, Ron, let me just ask frankly, specifically then. I mean, when we talk about names, are you talking about immigrants giving their children Western or European-sounding names?
So the way we do it is think about it. Let's say, imagine for a second the 1910 census. So we have all the people in the United States. We can see all the immigrant families, and we see the household, including their first, second, third, fourth, all their children and their names. And then what we can do is we can ask a question, for example, as of 1900, how many people in the that are born in the United States have a particular name, and how many immigrants have a particular name? So then we can kind of like, for example, if your name is Ron, then I know for sure you were born outside of the United States, so you get like 100 in this measure. And if your name is Jared, then I know for sure you were born in the United States, so you get like a zero in the foreignness of your name. And if your name is David, then I'm not sure where you are born, so maybe you get then a 50. And so then we can, once we define what's an American, what are names that Americans give to their children, we can ask the question, do immigrants give their children more American-sounding names when they spend more years in the United States?
Okay.
What's interesting here, Meghna, is that names do not have an inherent Americanness. So the name Eric is my favorite example. If you look at the name Eric in the 1920 census, many people who have that name are from Scandinavia. And very few people who are born in the U.S. have that name. And so if you met a random Eric in 1920, you would probably infer that that person was an immigrant. If you look at the modern data, it's completely the opposite. Eric is a very popular name among the U.S. born. So names can change over time in their degree of Americanness. And so we think it's really important to emphasize that we're not talking about giving kids names that are kind of standard classic Western names.
Uh-huh.
But the names that in your time period, given the names that are popular in the moment that you're choosing how to name your kid, tended to be given by immigrant families or tended to be given by American families.
Yeah. So we are talking this hour with Leah Bustan and Ron Abramitsky. They are two economists, one from Princeton, one from Stanford, who have taken the tools of big data to help answer this question about do immigrants assimilate more slowly today than in the past? And we want to know what your question is, maybe your own immigrant story or that of your family. What did you feel the process of assimilation was like? What is it like? Okay, so Leah and Ron, it's time for me to just come clean with you. I'm struggling a little here with the very premise of, since you mentioned that your research on names a couple times, I'll focus on my personal struggle with this, because, I mean, Ron, you're an immigrant yourself. I'll use my personal story here. I am the child of immigrants. My parents came from India. They, in the mid-70s, so in the second sort of big wave that you and Leah look at in terms of America's immigrant story, they named me and my brother very Indian names. My own children, who are actually of mixed race, have even more Indian names than I do. And I'm just thinking to myself, I do not see the correlation at all between the names that we have, three generations of Americans now, and our assimilation into this country. I just don't see it. And so I wonder, you know, are we putting too much emphasis on these decisions that some people might make as indicators of how American they become or their families become?
So you're absolutely right that, cultural assimilation is a very, very multidimensional thing, and you can become American by, there are so many ways in which you can become American, celebrating Thanksgiving and the 4th of July and identifying yourself in the country in so many ways. And of course, names is only like one measure. Now, one of the things that I was like you thinking about it. In Palo Alto, where I live, everybody is giving their children very ethnic names, and there seems to be no problem with this. But I think that this is like a feature of living in educated enclaves and things like that. You should think so, for example, our prior was that in today's California, we wouldn't be finding this to such a large degree that immigrants give their children more American sounding names. But, apparently if you're a Mexican immigrant and you worry about giving your son and a Mexican-sounding name that might generate discrimination in the labor market and that might signal something that hurt the prospects of your child, then one relatively easy way of identifying with U.S. culture in a way that will be potentially beneficial to your child is to give them a more American-sounding name. So that's the premise of this.
Okay, so respectfully, I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon, which is extremely white, a much smaller community. Yeah. Relatively well educated, but super white. So, and it still wasn't an issue there. But Leah, to the point that Ron is making, again, because I am very engaged with this question of Americanness, which is at the heart of sort of what your research is about. Maybe Ron's point about there are certain groups in America who are the target today in 2020 of far more discrimination than others, and are we seeing more of this naming decisions amongst those groups? Should we be looking with more sort of a sharper microscope here between different immigrant groups?
Well, exactly right. One thing we can do in our data set, because they're large enough, is we can separate different immigrant groups. And so in the past, the immigrants that politicians would point to as being unwilling or unable to assimilate were immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, who are the most recent arrivals when we're talking about 1910 or 20. So these would be immigrants from Italy or Portugal or Spain, immigrants from Russia and Poland. And when we separate the data by country of origin in the past, we find that it's precisely those immigrant groups that were fastest at selecting American-sounding names for their kids as they spent time in the country. Mm. So immigrants that might look more similar to the existing U.S.-born, like Germans or Scandinavians, were actually slower at putting down their ethnic names and picking up American-sounding names instead. So you're right that it could be that this phenomenon is somewhat of a defensive assimilation move for groups that worry that having an ethnic name from that particular group might be taken as a bad signal in the labor market or among peers at school.
Yeah.
And today we are able to pick out a couple of different groups in the California data. Because we have data from California only, our sample is very heavily Mexican-born.
Mm-hmm.
Two-thirds of the moms in our data set who were born abroad are born in Mexico. And so many of the overall patterns that we see in California are driven by that population. If you split the data into Mexicans and then a set of other countries that are identified in the California data set, we see that Mexicans are indeed the fastest at shifting from foreign-sounding to American-sounding names. So we don't mean to imply that this phenomenon is going on for every group. It might be that if you're from a smaller immigrant group or an immigrant group that arrives already well-educated, the patterns could be quite different.
And let me just put this out there. And Ron, I'll turn this to you. I take it that this means you're also not implying that those groups who don't adopt more American-sounding names, that they are not assimilated, right? Because I think that's the thing that I kind of keep stopping at.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely not. I mean, we don't. Again, we think about it at some level, you know, a society that is open to immigrants should not require their immigrants to assimilate and should be open to adopt like different cultures and identities. But rather, this is we thought this is one particular marker of identity that can actually be systematically collected. So we are based on, you know, our data is based on 15 million records, and you can actually compare it in the past and the present to kind of see one slice, one dimension that is actually a tool that is available both for the poor and the rich. So it doesn't cost money to raise your kids, and see whether on this one single dimension we see this assimilation into the U.S., acknowledging, of course, that there are so many other ways immigrants can integrate into society without even when they don't change their name. I would say, Meghna, if I can mention one more thing, I think it's important to know that, you know, we kind of talk a lot about the names, but Leah and I are working over the last decade or more on other aspects of bringing data, big data, and long-term perspective on the immigration debate. And one of them, another dimension that is we find very comparable between the past and the present, has to do with economic integration. So, you know, the idea that maybe both in the past and today, it is true that immigrants tend to earn, you know, less than the native born in the first generation. But one of the things we find is that the children of immigrants, they do great. They catch up, and you know, like oftentimes they do even better than the native born, and that's regardless of which country they come from. And so we don't want to give a sense in which it's all about just the name.
Sure.
This is just like one aspect.
And I'm really glad you said that. Respectfully, Ron and Leah, I mean, I wanted to avoid the names conversation too. but you guys actually said it's one of your favorite data, favorite ways of analyzing
this. It's a fun paper.
So I wanted to honor the fact that it is actually part of your work. Because from all the conversations that we've had over the many years on this program about immigration, from our own lived experience, I mean, I actually think that those other axes that you were talking about, economic integration, language, things like that, are far more potent and I think meaningful measures of assimilation than names. And so I'm glad you brought that up. And I want to explore the other areas of research, too. But again, just in my defense, you guys are the ones who did the research on names and you brought it up on the show. But I do have one comment that's come in on Facebook from a genealogist that's wondering about the reliability of names as reported on the census here. So Jen asks, there's a massive difference in the names reported on the census and those on birth certificates. She says, as a hobby genealogist, I've got a reasonable amount of experience with historical census records. They were often reported with nicknames, Americanized names, or just incorrect information given by neighbors. A birth certificate is an official document. Thus, the census will show a likely name that people are using at that point in time, not their birth name. Are you comparing apples and oranges? Leah, what do you think?
Well, that's a great point. And so I can bring in a family story of my own. My grandmother, her name is Rosalind, and she always told us that when she was born, her name was Rose, but that Rose was considered too much of an immigrant-sounding name. So when she went to second grade, her teacher told her, why don't you switch your name to Rosalind? And then she came home that day and told her parents, and from then on, she was Rosalind. I never believed her story because I thought, well, what 7-year-old comes home and tells their parents that they have a new name, and now suddenly they go by that name? Well, I looked up my grandmother in the census records, and indeed, I found her when she was 2 and when she was 12. When she was 2, she was Rose. When she was 12, she was Rosalind. I don't know if the second grade teacher story is accurate, but it's certainly consistent with that. So the point is that names on the census forms can change a lot over a person's lifetime if they go by a nickname when they're a kid and then a more formal name as an adult, if they Americanize their name, as my grandmother did, over the course of their life. So what we do to try to make a little more comparability is to try to limit our data to kids who have not yet been in school, kids between the ages of 0 and 5, and see if the results are similar when we focus in on that subsample, where we think that the names might be more comparable to birth certificate records. But I agree with you that these are two different data sets, and so there's going to be an inherent inability to fully compare to the extent that sometimes parents will give a formal legal name on a birth certificate that then is never used over the course of the lifetime.
Right. And then people...
And if I...
Oh, yeah, go ahead. No, please go ahead, Ron.
If I can add to it, the one particular way in which we underestimate, for example, name assimilation, cultural assimilation in California's data today is, for example, when it comes to, say, Asian immigrants. So because of the birth certificate, you know, like Asians sometimes use a name that is different from their given name for purpose of social interaction in the U.S. And that's one way to integrate into the social, into the broader culture, which will not be captured by the birth certificate.
Right. And then there are other groups of Asians, like the one I come from, where we just, right, we're just going to go for it and use those South Asian names. I grew up with people saying, can I call you Meg? And I'm like, no, it's Meghna. We'll be okay. It's two syllables, M-E-G-H-N-A. We'll talk a lot more about what big data says about immigrants and assimilation in America when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Leah Bustan. She's a professor of economics at Princeton University. And with Ron Abramitsky. He's a professor of economics at Stanford University. And for several years, they've been taking a look at this question of whether immigrants or how immigrants assimilate into the United States. And they've been using the tools of big data to help answer that question. And their most recent paper about it appears in the American Economic Review Insights, that journal, under the headline, Do Immigrants Assimilate More Slowly Today Than in the Past? And let's go to our calls, because we've got a lot of interesting callers on this. Let's start with Jeanette, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Jeanette, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a similar story to Rose and Rosalind, where when my family immigrated to America and to Atlanta at the end of 1951, my parents were Holocaust survivors. And when I was 3 and a half at the time, and when I entered school, well, at the time, my parents were calling me by my Yiddish name, Hanale. This is Hannah, like a diminutive Yiddish form of Hannah, Hanale. And when I went to school, I was embarrassed about my name. I knew that was not an American name. And we had Jewish teachers at my elementary school, and my teacher renamed me Jeanette. And I was delighted. I went back home, told my family, you know, my name's Jeanette. Everybody's going to call me Jeanette.
Uh-huh.
And my parents were very reluctant to call me Jeanette. It took years for them to really get it. My brother called me Jeanette. My friends called me Jeanette. But my mother, my father, they hung on to Hanale. But the teacher wanted us to assimilate quickly, and that was the idea.
And Jeanette, it sounds like it helped. Did it?
Well, it did help. It absolutely helped. It made me feel a lot more comfortable and part of the group. It helped me assimilate, yeah. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Jeanette. Let's go to Carmela, who's calling from Millerton, Pennsylvania. Carmela, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My family experience, I'm of Italian heritage, and my father's family came in the late 19th century to Philadelphia area with Italian names. He was one of eight, and all of his sisters and brothers and himself had children. I'm one of 12. All of the kids were named with family first names. But then when we married, I'm one of 12, six of us married non-Italians, and six married people of Italian heritage. And And the kids have names like, you know, Ivy and Ava and Lily, their children, you know, like my great nieces and nephews, and even some of my nieces and nephews have, you know, Robin, Patty, you know, it's, I think it just happens naturally that when an ethnic groups come to different countries, foreign countries, they stay within their group because culturally, language-wise, they're familiar with it, and also they have the economic connections.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that when you're in a country, then eventually you do just naturally assimilate because you go to school and you go to school. I went to school with kids of all different ethnicities. So,
yeah.
But I did want to ask a question. Did they take into consideration the difference in the economics? Like my mother's father worked on the underground Broad Street subway. There was so much infrastructure being done at that time that you could stay within your ethnic group, find work. You didn't need to go into other groups. Maybe you worked with them. Where now the economic needs are different in the country, which I think is one of the reasons why immigrants aren't accepted as readily as they were in the last century and the century before, because they needed their labor.
So, Carmela, thank you so much for that question. There's a lot in that. And Ron, let me first turn to you. Do you have an answer to her question about whether the sort of the economic makeup of the country today versus in 1900 is significant, is different enough that might be one of the ways to understand this question of assimilation?
For sure, it's different, and this is like in some sense one of the reasons why we find these findings of name so name assimilation so remarkable is that despite all the changes that have occurred, we still see that immigrants give their children more American sounding names, and eventually erasing about half of the naming gap between theirs and native. But I think also, you know, Carmela and Jeanette, you can see that how much they, from what they say, how much they struggle between this, you know, maintaining the original cultural identity for the benefits of assimilation. And that's what we wanted to capture more than just, you know, say, oh, they assimilate. It's kind of like to capture this trade-off of maintaining your identity with the benefits of assimilation.
Yeah.
And what do immigrants choose, and whether immigrants of certain countries have a stronger sense of retaining their identity and so on.
So, Leah, you know, one of the reasons why I am forever, how would I describe it? I am a deeply loyal critic of the United States, but underscore loyalty is because one of the great ironies of this country is, you know, we just heard in those callers and as is emerging from your research, the very fact that certain immigrants might feel like they should name their children more American names is evidence of the resistance to foreignness that has always been part of this nation's story. But then give it a generation or two and what was once foreign becomes American, right? And that's the other side of this coin. And what I'm wondering is your and Ron's research bearing out that the speed of that transition, is it the same today between, you know, does it take just a generation as it did in 1900? And really, we are just living the same story over again.
Well, again and again in our work, we come back to that conclusion. That's not where we started, and it's not where we thought we were heading. But, for example, when we're looking at the children of immigrants in the past and in the present, we're finding that for the immigrant groups that start out earning less than the U.S.-born, their children are completely catching up, both in the past and in the present, to the same degree. So the names of the countries and the ethnic groups that these immigrants come from are different, but the degree of social mobility of the children is the same. And that social mobility seems to occur within one generation, both in the past and today.
So isn't that remarkable? I mean, I feel like that's a great thing about this country.
Right.
Ron, is that you? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. So the again, just to follow up on what Leah said, that we find over and over again that this short-term perspective on immigrants' assimilation, just looking at you know, the first generation and the first couple of years when immigrants come to this country, this short-term perspective on immigrant assimilation that politicians tend to take might underestimate the long-run success of immigrants, because by the second generation, they are doing great. And even in the first generation, they make significant and notable efforts to join U.S. society.
Hmm. So let's go back to the John Kelly quote that we started the hour with.
Right.
He said, many undocumented immigrants are coming from countries where the norm is to have a sixth or a seventh grade education. And implicit in that statement is that somehow that background will be destiny. And so if you come to the U.S. with a sixth or seventh grade education, that's where you'll stay. And that's where your children will stay. And what we're finding is that there's some amount of upward mobility for the first generation, but a lot of the mobility happens for the kids. And even if you're coming from a country where your parents have a sixth or seventh grade education, the children are able to achieve much more and to the same degree now than they did in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I've always struggled with is I do not understand why some of the people who the very same people who say these things have forgotten that their grandparents or great-grandparents probably came to this country with exactly the same amount of education. I mean, it's not as if in 1900 or 1880 we were importing a whole bunch of people toting PhDs around. I mean, our short historical memory in this country, I think, is actually part of the problem. And your research is helping sort of illuminate what the truth is. And I very much appreciate that. So let's go back to the – Rhonda, I just want to get another caller in here for a second. So if I may, let's go to Tony, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Tony, you're on the air.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. And before I begin, let me just congratulate you guys on having a really fascinating conversation that's really been long, long overdue. So I created a project about 12 years ago called the Immigrant Archive Project, where I've traveled the country from coast to coast, and I literally have interviewed over 2,500 immigrants sharing their personal narrative, that personal immigrant story. And what I can tell you is that I think the question needs to be rephrased. It's not so much are immigrants assimilating any more slowly today than they were a couple of generations ago, but how has this new wave of immigrants redefined assimilation, mainly due to the advent of social media and technology?
Right. Tony, this is a great question. I mean, when my parents came to the United States in 1970, the best they had were those blue aerograms and the occasional very expensive phone call. And now my mother, who's like the most American person I know, Tony, she's like, well, you know, like the young Indians that she knows coming into the United States now, she's like, it's like they never have to leave home because they're on WhatsApp and you know, Facebook Messenger all the time with their family back in India. I mean, it's a huge difference.
It's an immense difference, and I'll tell you, you'd be hard pressed to find a migrant farm worker working the field today that doesn't have a smartphone in their pocket. And I've interviewed so many of them, and they all tell me that before they go to sleep at night, they're able to tuck in their children in Guatemala or in Mexico or in El Salvador. That was not available to my family and I when we came to this country in 1967 from Cuba. Mm. You know, we would send a letter. It would take weeks for our family to receive it. You know, it would take weeks for them to respond. Phone calls were very sporadic at best. So, you know, they are redefining assimilation. It used to be that assimilation that you became 100% American and you forgot your language, you forgot your culture. Mm. I think the new assimilation is, as I've seen, is becoming 200%. You're no longer 100% American or 100% Italian. You're 200%.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it broadens your perspective. You listen to, you know, a different variety of music. You watch more films.
Tony, I'm going to step in here, and I'm sorry about that, but your cell phone is kind of like, it's coming in and out just a little bit. But thank you so much for your call and your perspective. Ron, would you like to respond to Tony?
Oh, those are all great points, and love it that he's been collecting immigrant stories. And one of the other things we do with the big data is we collected also like many stories of immigrants saying that in Ellis Island and other sources to kind of learn more about, they use like language tools to try to understand more like what the experience was like and how it changed and things like that. And I would also add to your point that it's exactly right. It's exactly what we find, that it's people forget about how things in the past were very similar, and it's they voice the same concerns only targeted a different immigrant group. So if in the past it was the Germans complaining about the Italians and the Irish, now it's those past immigrant groups complaining about Mexicans and Muslim immigrants. And it's the same story over and over again. And one of the overreaching messages of our work is we should avoid this nostalgic view about the past. And
So actually, I'm very glad that you brought that up, Ron, because we've got 4-ish minutes here left. And what I'm hoping to end with is some advice from you and Leah about what your research and what these data say about what policy on immigration should be, right? Because it's forever been fraught with a lot of emotion and politics here. But, you know, how should we be designing immigration policy? And Leah, I'll start with you, based on sort of the facts and the analysis that you have that you and Ron have uncovered here.
Well, first, I want to make a meta point that a lot of what we think we know about immigration comes from our own family stories.
Yeah.
And so we've seen Meghna at the top of the hour said, I'm not sure that these names measures actually capture cultural assimilation, because in my family and in the South Asian community, there's a continuation of a naming tradition, even to the second and the third generation.
I will admit that I fell into the trap of N equals one in that case.
Right, but then we hear from Carmela, who has an Italian background, and by the time she gets to the third generation, she has Lilies and Ivies in the family. And we hear from Jeanette, who just herself within the first generation is changing names. So we've heard a whole range of family stories in the hour. And I think that those are stories we should hold on to and draw wisdom from. But we always have to check them against the big data. And so in the data, we see that when immigrants arrive in the country, they behave differently than the U.S. born on a number of dimensions that we probably can't see, but on one dimension that we can, which are the names they give to their kids. Fast forward 20 years and their behavior has converged quite a bit with the U.S. born. So my policy message is that we should be drawing our policy from large data sets and from social analysis rather than from our own family stories and anecdotes that we can use to drive voters and drive a political message. So pointing to one criminal or pointing to one CEO, both of whom happen to have been born abroad, is not the way to make policy. We need to know, are these stories typical? Are they the norm? Or is the typical immigrant waking up, bringing their kids to school, going off to work and coming home just like the rest of us?
Right. Well, so Ron, we've got about a minute left here. And what I want to know is, in terms of policy, are you and Leah saying that whatever nostalgic views we may have of immigration in the past, what we're actually seeing is that there's a core American story that the same patterns of immigration and assimilation that we had a century ago, we have today?
Yes, almost everything we look at, we find that the pace of economic and cultural assimilation is similar in the past and present. And if nothing else, it would be a mistake to determine immigration policy based on the belief that immigrants will remain foreigners and will not make efforts to join and integrate into this economy and country.
Well, Ron Abramitsky, professor of economics at Stanford University and also author of The Mystery of the Kibbutz, Egalitarian Principles in a Capitalist World. Thank you so much, Ron, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Leah Bustan, professor of economics at Princeton University, also author of Competition in the Promised Land, Black Migrants in Northern Cities and Labor Markets. Leah, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Leah and Ron, by the way, are working together to write a book focusing on the American dream and two centuries of immigration. Some of their work is already available in this paper that we've been talking about this hour called Do Immigrants Assimilate More Slowly Today Than in the Past? It appeared in the journal American Economic Review Insights, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you.